What do we do here? We listen to many talks and attend study classes. We gather knowledge and absorb wisdom, so we say. We practice various types of meditation. We also enjoy some fun and games, quite innocent, tennis and baby golf and so forth. We experience uplift. We receive comfort. We seek solutions from others for some of our problems. We find some satisfactions and perhaps some perplexities. We seek teachers. If we find them, we want to follow them and be their disciples. There are undercurrents of agreements and disagreements, of appreciations, evaluations, criticisms, and judgments. There is a vast bubbling of ideas and a turmoil of thoughts. Most of all, there is furious chatter, but not as much conversation. We go away from here with happy memories, refreshed. We believe we have gone ahead spiritually and are pleased about it. A goal called nirvana or perfection or Buddhahood may seem nearer. We may even secretly believe that we are almost there. Some of us may become filled with missionary zeal, while someone who perhaps is constitutionally a bit lemony will squirt acidic remarks upon everything. Let us together consider a few matters carefully and seriously. First note that consider is probably derived from con, together with, and sidus sideris, a star. So, consideration means looking intently or deeply into the stars, which are self-shining lights. And similarly, desire from desiderare means looking down from, away from, the light. Here in this meeting, how do we listen? Each member of the audience has his own preconceptions about the speaker, his own prejudgments, that is, prejudices, about the speaker's merits or demerits. What is the truth about these preconceptions and prejudices? Will they allow you to listen to the speaker? Will they not hinder you from hearing truthfully? You have your own expectations of what the speaker will say. Behind them lurks the fear of disappointment. There is a suppressed awareness of one's own insufficiency in face of the basic fear that oneself will be overpowered or wiped out by the vast not-self, the universe. So, like a fish floundering on dry land, egoistic self-consciousness is consumed with the passion to hear such words as will feed its feverish desires for permanence and bliss, as will bolster up its illusory beliefs about enlightenment and nirvana. If your expectations are satisfied and your beliefs supported, will you have seen truth, realized Dhamma? If not satisfied, not supported, will you feel, the speaker is not the same man I knew last year? What has happened to shift him off the rails? But if you do come to see truth, then whence the judgment? Is it not based on assumptions and preconceptions, even if deeply hidden, of what truth is? But is not seeing truth an immediate understanding in the living here now, undistorted by formed ideas, by any fixations whatsoever? Consider carefully. The appearance is that we want to see truth to be enlightened. And the reality? Is it not that we are grasping after ideas, sanya, which we can parade as knowledge or use for advancing the ego self to a desired goal or to satisfy ambitions? Sometime after the Enlightenment, the Buddha sat under the goatherd's banyan tree for 7 days in deep meditation. A Brahmin, who kept muttering, a sound made out of arrogance and in anger, approached him and asked, "To what extent does one become a Brahmin? And again, what are the things which make a Brahmin?" And the Lord answered, "That Brahmin who bars out evil things, not uttering the sound hu, with no impurity, curbed of self, master of the Vedas, who lives the Brahma faring, this is the Brahmin who may rightly speak the Brahma word." Listen now to what is being said. Bodhi, enlightenment, is here now. You are hearing the Dhamma. You are hearing the voice of enlightenment. Did we listen? Or did we merely hear words? Did not the surface mind, with lightning speed, give those words the stereotyped meanings we already know? And therefore, we are no different from what we were before those words were said. Has not the mere hearing by ear and brains stood like an impregnable wall, preventing us from enlightening hearing, prevented us from true listening, which is, in the Buddha's terms, hearing with right wisdom? Do we now see at least one aspect of what the Buddha meant by the peril of the senses in the context of the religious life? So the appearance is that you are listening with right wisdom, but the reality? Is it not simply a churning up of your own dead knowledge? An acquisition of someone else's idea patterns, lifeless fixations? An intensification of self? And a bypassing of that perpetual creative renewal through death. That is, through dropping the burden, through that listening or seeing which is pure attentiveness. Are not some minds now wondering, what is the speaker getting at? Is he suggesting that we have been following a will-o'-the-wisp? Is he trying, perhaps in a veiled way out of modesty, to foist himself as the teacher? Or is he really, the Buddha help us, an enlightened one? And so, are you not in conflict because of the contradictions raised by confused doubting. And so also, are not some of you straining atrophied mental muscles to safeguard yourselves against some coming shock, instead of being totally open to love, and therefore to being vulnerable, to being hurt, wholly open to searching discontent, to inquiring doubt, and to suffering? But, you say, it is precisely for ridding ourselves of suffering that we have come here, exactly for the sake of having our doubts resolved and clarity established that we listen to you. Is that really so? I say, you will never be rid of the doubt born of confusion as long as you hear another in the way you do hear. I say, you will never be rid of suffering, of dukkha. The Mephistophelian mind now tries to dodge. Of course, the speaker means that my existential being, my khandhas, my ego sense, etc., will never be rid of dukkha. But I am sure that at the end of the path, in superconsciousness, in the realized transcendence, when I am one with the all mind, when I have reached Buddhahood, etc., etc., I will know nirvana. You won't. I repeat, you will never be rid of dukkha. You want authority for this? Very well, you have my authority for it. Does this trouble your heart? Does it really trouble your heart? May we all be blessed with real trouble. Trouble that will shatter every concept till our mind is again virgin, pure. For then, whatever is said will bring forth the enlightened state. You want better authority than mine? Have it your way. In the Book of the Golden Precepts, the teacher declares, the first path is liberation. The path the second is renunciation, and therefore called the path of woe. The secret path leads the Arhant to mental woe unspeakable. Thus the path to Buddhahood is filled with unutterable woe. Unutterable not only because it is indescribable, but also because it is never uttered by him who holds it in his throbbing heart of compassion. Ah, you say, but that is just the woe of others, not the Arhant's own dukkha. Are you sure? What meaning has the word others for an Arhant? With minds comfortably doped by authoritative assurance, we can happily move to the next topic. But wait, I will give you topmost authority. The Buddha said, now look you, Kalamas, do not be misled by report, tradition, or hearsay. Do not be misled by proficiency in the pitakas, the baskets of sayings on discipline and the Dhamma, nor by mere logic and inference. Nor after considering reasons, nor after reflection on some view and approval of it. Nor because the recluse who holds it is your teacher. But when you know for yourselves These things are not good. These things are faulty. These things are censured by the intelligent. These things, when performed and undertaken, conduce to loss and sorrow. Then do you reject them. But if at any time ye know of yourselves, these things are profitable, they are blameless, they are praised by the intelligent. These things, when undertaken and performed, conduce to profit and happiness. Then, O Kalamas, having undertaken them, do ye abide therein. So much then for wanting authority. Now the ball is in your court. So the appearance is that our bowels of compassion are moved by dukkha, and that deliverance from dukkha is our vital concern. And the reality? Is it not that we have not yet begun to understand the meaning of dukkha? That we are but seeking and attempting an escape from our worldly pains and sorrows, our dissatisfactions and frustrations, that we are playing about solemnly and pathetically with techniques for getting rid of what is actually present before we fully understand it, and that we do this in order to gain a pre-fancied, desired end, which, if you look with open eyes, you will see is nothing but a self-projection. Now the whole battery can be discharged at me. The Enlightened One himself gave us the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, of dukkha, its cause, its extinction, and the way. But look right into your heart. Do you directly see the teaching, the truth? Or are you spitting out verbal formulations labeled truth? Have not words come between you and the truth? Are not the mental patterns of truth made by your particular mind just what they are, precisely because they are shut through and through by your desires, your ambitions? Our grasping, greedy minds, slaves of the pleasure principle, are caught in the contradiction of conflicting desires. For all desires, in the moment of their birth, simultaneously breed their own opposites. Such being our minds, dull and stupid, can we, by taking thought, or through idea patterns, or by willfully changing character patterns, ever be free of destructive conflict and of illusions and delusions? Such minds, not being pure instruments of real intelligence, can never directly see, never have unerring insight, panya, into truth. But we shall remedy that, you say, by rooting out craving, by complete control over all desires. The Buddha himself said, cease to do evil, strive to do good, purify the mind. That is the way of the Buddhas. What is evil? What is good? Can I become good? Remember what the Buddha's brother said in Palestine. Why callest thou me good? There is only one that is good, and that is God. Can I be good? Is there a technique to be good? Yes, shouts the enthusiast, start by refraining from killing. Very well, I can refrain by suppressing my urges from killing a body by means of physical action. But can I refrain from killing you in thought? I cannot. Do you see why? It is because in the sphere of thinking, I am aware I have killed you in thought only after the thought of killing has arisen. So, can you cease to do evil? Can you root out or suppress or transform desire? And what happens if you try? I say, you cannot. I cannot. Very disheartening. But let us consider together, attentively and lovingly. Self-consciousness, that is, the consciousness of separateness from all that is other than I, fear and desire, that is tanha, the craving for separate sentient existence, which means the continuity of the self, all go together. In fact, these three, self-consciousness, fear, and tanha, are very closely knit together. The ignorant person is self-conscious. The unenlightened state, or ignorance, and self-consciousness are intimately united. Self-consciousness is terrified of the extinction of its continuity, of death. So, the ignorant one craves for continuity. He associates continuity with sensational pleasure. This association derives from the basic pleasure-pain mechanism of the living organism. The pain reaction spells danger and death. The pleasure reaction means the support of personal continuity. Our fundamental fear of extinction is bound up with hate, aversion. Our craving for continuity with attachment to all those urges or desires, the gratification of which produces pleasurable sensations. Of these urges, one of the most powerful is sex. Its physical mechanism is very simply the electrochemistry of the body, the psychical component of which we name sexual desire. The mental shapes of our sexual desire are formed by thought, by the verbalizing process. They are our sexual fantasies. This is where thought spoils the whole business and produces conflicts and problems. If there was only the thought-free urge, pure electrochemistry, we would directly experience discomfort if ungratified or comfort if gratified. There would be no problem about it. It is thought, the mind which recognizes, remembers, and plans action to obtain a desired result, the whole complex process of sexual desire in action. It is this mind which is responsible for the problem and the conflict. It is the thoughts about sexual gratification and not the pure sex urge per se which is the troublemaker. Being unperceiving, we proceed wildly. Hate, fear, anger, aggressiveness all go into battle. With blind fury, we try to root out not only lustful thoughts, but also the pure urge. The urge, the amoral, nameless and formless energy, cannot be rooted out except by the death of the body, for that alone can make an end of its electrochemistry. What has been said above applies to every manifestation of tanha. To try to kill desire means to go about like a living corpse. Subconsciously, at least, are we not aware of this? Being unfree, are we not afraid of it? also, do we not fear desire itself in relation to both gratification and frustration? Do we not fear our own perplexities and confusions? And can confused and fearful thought ever tame desire? So, what is the reality underneath all the appearances of our dealing with desire by means of thought? Can thought control or transform? How do we look at a person? We are not primarily aware of a human being, but of the sex of the person. We devour the person with our eyes and minds as we look, because tanha is immediately operative. There are attractions and repulsions, the passion to possess or to destroy, and immediate calculations as to how I can use that person for my pleasure or advantage. Whether the conscious mind does this or not, the unconscious is vigorously at it. And this takes place simply because it is our heritage. The million-year-old psychophysical organism is the evolutionary product of tanha. It functions in the ways of tanha. It is tanha concretized. Are you afraid now? Or is your mind in vain and useless self-defense just fighting against or rejecting outright what I'm saying? Or will you say, but by mindfulness I can stem the tide of tanha and become free of it and grow in purity towards enlightenment? I say you cannot. Because all becoming, even becoming pure and knowing, is the child of tanha. There is becoming only when there is self-consciousness, conflict, tanha, and avidya, ignorance. All your efforts are doomed to failure whenever the efforts are the consequence of predetermination or thought. You strive for a goal, nirvana. You want freedom and enlightenment. If you strive, if you want to attain, you have separated yourself from the totality of reality, from truth. Therefore, you obtain the wages of such separation, and such separation is sin. Yes, you just go to death. Have you ever examined the nature of the type of mindfulness you are talking of? Is it not a mindfulness raised up by desire? The desire for gaining perfection or bliss for yourself. Does not the desire, therefore, set up a watcher who is self-consciously watching thoughts, feelings, objects, people, events, etc., who is self-consciously walking mindfully, breathing mindfully, subjecting himself to this or that discipline which is supposed to bring about a desired result? Thus, desire raises up and maintains the continuous conflict between watcher and watched, between what is actual fact here now and a future ought to be, which is nothing but a self-projection by your mind, which you yourself acknowledge is unenlightened here now. Is not this conflict hell, which you yourself are strenuously perpetuating? I repeat, you cannot control or conquer desire. Tanha is the master magician whose power, whose strength is the power of the total universe, which includes you, a strength against which you are powerless. Do you then see clearly the appearance of this kind of mindfulness? It can undoubtedly produce results, for given the time, the power of the egoistic drive, the technique, and a pennyworth of luck. Yes, luck. And you will realize your self-projected ambition. Only for a while, though. Afterwards, you will discover it was an illusion. All gods, be they of lead or of gold, or the airy-fairy exalted variety mentioned by the Buddha in the Brahmajala Sutta, must be melted down when the depression comes, or fade away when they are seen face to face by the eyes which are the eternal light. The fruits of tanha inevitably dry, rot, and perish. One may say, but I accept the Dhamma and undertake the discipline in a selfless spirit for the sake of mankind, and I'm not concerned about what happens to me. Or one may make several other similar statements. The phrase, for the sake of the greater whole, means only a self-expansion. In fact, I have a much better chance of satisfaction by identifying myself with a society or country, or best of all, with the Almighty. Do we not see that a self can never become selfless? Our self-abnegations, born of imposed disciplines, lead only to a more tyrannical and more inflated self, whether we call it God or Supreme Self. These identifications and self-abnegations are but tricks of the mind. When we accept the Dhamma, any Dhamma, Buddhist, Hindu, Jewish, or any other, what exactly are we doing? We may be merely acquiescing without inquiry with what our elders impose upon us. Or we are being exploited by some crude evangelist greedy for merit. Or we may, after searching and study, express a preferential choice for a particular set of doctrines and disciplines, a particular view of life. On mere acquiescence or on being exploited, we need waste no time. But with regard to preferential choice, do I not make this on the grounds that this Dhamma satisfies my mind better than any other? But is not such satisfaction the same old pleasure principle at work? And if my mind is, as indeed it is, confused, suffering, and desire-ridden, is not any judgment or choice it makes also a confusion, another piece of dukkha? The appearance is that I am seeking truth or reality or whatever word you like. So I make a choice of a set of verbally formulated teachings, ideas, sannyā, which the Buddha designated as anicca, anatta, dukkha. And then we proceed quite sincerely and diligently to study these doctrines and practice certain laid-down disciplines leading to a goal pre-formulated by the mind. I know what school and university study means, obtaining information, acquiring knowledge, turning over idea patterns in my mind, coming to conclusions, producing physical results by applying knowledge, etc. All this holds good in the context of the becoming process, the limited and particular, the mortal, in short, the context of dukkha. But in the context of the transcendent, the immortal, the amata, as the Buddha said, in the context of that truth which is religion, the context of the boundless totality of the whole reality, can I use these worldly methods of study, of going to teachers and being taught, that is, being conditioned by them to reach the unconditioned nirvana, of constraining myself to become the unconstrained, the transcendental free. The Buddha gave a wonderful teaching. Come and see for yourselves. And also, look within. Thou art Buddha is one of the most significant Buddhist teachings. In other words, inquire, experiment, find out for yourselves and discover from within. The Buddha also spoke of a Magga, his noble eightfold way. Magga is the Sanskrit marga, which comes from the root mrig, which means to track or to trace. Never forget that the Tathagata cannot be traced, as the Buddha said, and that the way to and the way of the transcendence is the trackless flight of the alone to the alone, leaving not a trace behind. The great religions of India have certain teachings in common. We accept these teachings, and this acceptance is held as so many beliefs. Are these beliefs thought and speech formulations, truth in the transcendental sense? Tread the eightfold path successfully to the end, you say, and you will find they are all true. Of course I will. Do you not know how possible it is for the mind to formulate a goal, then follow some prescribed technique, and in due time realize the I told you so conclusion? I still say, what has this belief proved in this manner to do with truth in the transcendental sense? Consider one teaching which is basic to some great religions, the teaching of rebirth. Have we directly seen the truth in this matter? Or have we only conceptions about it, mere beliefs? We read in the Jatakas about some of the animal incarnations of the Buddha as well as human ones. In various discourses in which the Buddha describes events in the past happening to A, B, and C, he says at the end of the discourse, I was A, Yasodhara was B, Ananda was C, and so on. Again and again he declares that one of the deep insights he obtained after enlightenment, which can be obtained after entering the fourth jhana, was the vision of past habitations, pubbe nivasa, by the hundred thousands, and that he could remember his past states, jatis, up to 91 kalpas back. Similarly, in the Hindu writings, we have scores of examples of the so-called past lives of sages, kings, and others. Now, time has at least two aspects. One aspect is the time indicated by the clock and the calendar, furnished by the fact that the earth makes a complete rotation on its own axis once a day, and one revolution round the sun once a year. This chronological time, which is a mechanically exact rhythmic movement of the earth in relation to the sun, takes place independently of us. Each one of us, as a living organism, is born of the earth and sun. And our life ultimately depends on these two, our organic mother and father. We record and date all external events in chronological time, including the dates of birth and death of our own body. Within our chronological bodily lifetime, our psyche lives and functions in terms of the second aspect of time, which we may call psychological time, which is peculiarly elastic. If your little child is 10 minutes late from school, you experience a lifetime of anxiety, whereas 10 hours dancing with your sweetheart makes you curse the speed at which the clock moves. Thousands of times during the years of chronological time, you go through innumerable fantasies about who you would like to be and about what you would do, covering vast spans of time. In fact, you live through lifetimes in your imagination again and again. All these leave their impressions on the mind. Indeed, every stimulus, physical or mental, within the chronological lifespan of bodily existence leaves psychological time impressions in the mind. The psychological time span of experiences, events, fantasies, and impressions make up a kalpa. The word kalpa has no chronological equivalent in fact, although the people of India invented one later on to mollify the multitudes. The Jatakas, the Puranas of the Hindus, and all similar accounts are the exoteric, symbolical form for the truth of death, rebirth, and immortality. When reading this mythology of successive incarnations or the reincarnation idea, we misinterpret psychological time as chronological time. The appearance is that you lived many bodily lifetimes through thousands of centuries in the chronological past and will do so through the future until you arrive at your full stop, whatever and whenever that may be. The reality, or if you like the term, the esoteric truth, is that within the one and only chronological lifespan of the psychophysical organism, you live out innumerable psychological lifespans in mind. Expounding and discussing the various teachings on these matters all over the old world, H.P. Blavatsky writes in the first volume of Isis Unveiled, page 289, with respect to the purifying process of transmigrations, the metempsychosis, as follows. Neither Gautama Buddha nor Pythagoras intended to teach this purely metaphysical allegory literally. Esoterically, it relates to the purely spiritual peregrinations of the soul. In the second volume, page 286, she writes, metempsychosis was only a succession of disciplines through refuge heavens, that is, in Buddhist or Hindu terms, coursing through the Deva realms and the different lokas entered in the jhanas. Moreover, there is no trace of the popular reincarnational idea in the Rig Veda. The Jewish Zohar indicates that the transmigration of the soul does not relate to man's condition on this earth after death. If all this is really understood, do we not see that the kalpas and kalpas of lives represent the innumerable paticca-samuppada cycles of my own vijnana, or my own discriminative self-consciousness? Is not the reincarnation idea an expression of the craving for the continuity of my ego? Does it not show that I have not understood death, rebirth, and life? What has been said about this teaching applies also to many other teachings. The appearance, then, is that we accept the Dhamma. The reality is perhaps a tipsy gyration in a turmoil of beliefs and fancies. Are you perplexed by my use of the word rebirth, despite my rejection of the naive reincarnation idea? Let us consider carefully. The atoms and molecules of matter vibrate incessantly with such rapidity that we cannot see this motion constrained between two extremes. We say that the object is still, doing nothing. Mind and consciousness also vibrate incessantly. Is it not said by the Sarvastivadins that a unit of matter lasts for 17 thought moments? And since a unit of matter lasts for an incredibly small fraction of a second, a thought moment lasts an even more incredibly short time. In brief, birth, death, rebirth, re-death, rebirth, re-death succeed each other so rapidly, the eye sense springs and re-springs so swiftly that we are bound fast in the illusion of the unbroken continuity of a single persisting self. This birth, death, rebirth, re-death is a real phenomenon in our moment-to-moment consciousness during our bodily lifetime. Because self-consciousness fears extinction by the all-powerful not-self, that is, by the universe, we cling hard to birth and becoming and try our best to stave off death. Consequently, our real rebirth from moment to moment is in a partly corpse-like condition. We drag the dead past, mutilated and burdensome though it is, into the present, the living now. We go against the Buddha's teaching of Nirodha, fading away, and of non-grasping, we of little faith and intelligence, and thereby prevent our true renewal from moment to moment. In fact, we refuse to die wholly to the past. We crave to become something, again un-Buddhistically, and refuse to face the fact that we are nothing. If we die completely to the past every moment, then we are wholly and truly reborn the next moment. Wholly and truly. Listen with pure attention. Death is the extinction of continuity. It is not annihilation. It is the interval between two births. This interval is a silence, a full void, an empty plenum, a still movement, a non-manifesting, motiveless action. It is not knowable by thought desire, but it is spoilt or obstructed by thought desire. If obstructed, the creativity of the transcendent remains obscure to us. We remain in darkness. If unobstructed, we are reborn the next moment, enlightened. In the silence, which is death fully awake, wholly alive, the transcendent, the unborn and unmade, creates anew. From here comes renewal. This new that is born is utterly pure and perfect. It is Buddha. It is Tathā manifest. And it is so, if the old had the wisdom, the skill, the love, and the freedom to die totally. If not, the new is tainted by the old, which is a corpse, a source of putrefaction. The clinging to the old, by the old, to the known form, is tanha. If free of tanha, one is capable of dying perfectly, that is, of entering the silent void. Hence the new state, created by the transcendent, unhindered and unspoilt by a self-conscious you, is new. The rebirth is a new birth. Thus does life abundant flow. The new birth is a new creation, not a mere continuity of the old, not karma in the mortal sphere, but the transcendent action of the immortal. The perfect dying is also the transcendent action of the immortal. This action is transcendent karma, free, blissful, unbound and non-binding, liberating. The spoiler of perfect dying and perfect renewal is tanha. Desires, thoughts, beliefs, plannings, carryings on and carryings over. Can we see now what is implied in accepting the Dhamma? Does it not imply freedom from beliefs which are but cobwebs of thought, mere verbiage? Can we see now that the deep significance of accepting the Dhamma is that we should directly see truth? You may now feel, but you categorically said earlier, you can never be rid of tanha. And now you say, if you are free of tanha, there is true renewal. Consider. Self-consciousness, fear, and tanha go together. All mindfulness, purposively directed by self-consciousness and exclusively concentrated on any particular object or event or goal, is not the samasati of the Buddha's Eightfold Path. But when you are fully attentive to the total changing situation, to the flowing movement of life in its wholeness, and if this attentiveness is free of praise or censure, attachment or aversion, in short, free of any and every personal choice, then the self-conscious I is no longer there, quite naturally. And the burden of fear and tanha drops off by itself, quite naturally. And the silent void, immeasurable, beautiful, the unconditioned unknown, takes you into its own eternity. This is love. This is freedom. This is reality.